I'd seen this one coming, and drawn a sheaf of currency through an auto bank on the way down through the city. I selected one of the large denomination plasticized notes and fed it into the slot. Punched the commence button. My credit flashed up in LED red. The door hinged smoothly shut behind me, muffling the music, and a body thudded against the frosted glass ahead with an abruptness that made me twitch. The display digits flickered to life. Minimal expenditure so far. I studied the body pressed against the glass. Heavy breasts pressed flat, a woman's profile, and the indistinct lines of hips and thighs. Piped moaning came softly through hidden speakers. A voice gusted.
"Do you want to see me, see me, see me?"
Cheap echo box in the vocoder. I pressed the button again. The glass unfrosted, and the woman on the other side became visible. She shifted, side to side, showing herself to me. Worked-out body, augmented breasts, leaned forward and licked the glass with the tip of her tongue, breath misting it again. Her eyes locked onto mine.
"Do you want to touch me, touch me, touch me?"
Whether the cabins used subsonics or not, I was getting a definite reaction from it all. My penis thickened and stirred. I locked down the throbbing, forced the blood back out and into my muscles the way a combat call would do. I needed to be limp for this scene. I reached for the debit button again. The glass screen slid aside and she stepped through like someone coming out of a shower. She moved up to me. One hand slid out, cupping.
"Tell me what you want, honey,"
she said from somewhere in the base of her throat. The voice seemed hard-edged, deprived of the vocoder effect. I cleared my throat. "What's your name?"
"Anemone. Want to know why they call me that?"
Her hand worked. Behind her, the meter was clicking over softly. "You remember a girl used to work here?" I asked. She was working on my belt now.
"Honey, any girl used to work here ain't gonna do for you what I am. Now how would you..."
She was called Elizabeth. Her real name, Elizabeth Elliot. Her hands fell abruptly away, and the mask of arousal slid off her face as if it was greased underneath.
"What the fuck is this? You the Sia?"
"The what?"
"The Sia, the heat."
Her voice was rising. She stepped away from me.
"We had this man."
"No." I took a step toward her, and she dropped into a competent-looking defensive crouch. I backed up again, voice low. "No. I'm her mother." Taut silence. She glared at me.
"Bullshit! Lizzie's ma's in the store."
"No." I pulled her hand back to my groin. "Feel. There's nothing there. They sleeved me in this, but I'm a woman. I couldn't..." She unbent fractionally from her crouch, hands tugging almost unwillingly down.
"That looks like prime tank flesh to me,"
she said untrustingly.
"You just come out of the store. How come you're not paroled in some bone bag junkie sleeve?"
"It's not parole." The Corps' deep cover training came rocketing in across my mind like a flight of low-level strike jets, spinning vapor trail lies on the edge of plausibility and half-known detail. Something inside me tilted with the joy of mission time.
"You know what I went down for?"
"Lizzie said mine bites. Something..."
"Yeah. Dipping. You know who I dipped?"
"No. Lizzie never talked much about..."
"Elizabeth didn't know. And it never came out on the wires."
The heavy-breasted girl put her hands on her hips.
"So who..."
I skinned her a smile.
"Better you don't know. Someone powerful. Someone with enough pull to unstack me and give me this."
"Not powerful enough to get you back in something with a pussy, though."
An enemy's voice was still doubtful, but the conviction was coming up fast, like a bottleback school under reef water. She wanted to believe this fairy tale mother come looking for her lost daughter.
"How come you're cross-sleeved?"
"There's a deal,"
I told her, gliding near the truth to flesh out the story.
"This person gets me out, and I have to do something for them. something that needs a man's body. If I do it, I get a new sleeve for me and Elizabeth.
That's so. So why are you here?
There was an edge of bitterness in her voice that told me her parents would never come to this place looking for her, and that she believed me. I laid the last pieces of the lie.
There's a problem with resleeving Elizabeth. Someone's blocking the procedure. I want to know who it is and why. You know who cut her up?
She shook her head, face turned down.
A lot of the girls get hurt,
she said quietly.
But Jerry's got insurance to cover that. He's real good about it. Even puts us into store if it's going to take a long time to heal. But whoever did Lizzie wasn't a regular.
Did Elizabeth have regulars? Anyone important? Anyone strange?
She looked up at me, pity showing in the corners of her eyes. I'd played Irene Elliott to the hilt.
Mrs. Elliott, all the people who come here are strange. They wouldn't be here if they weren't.
I made myself wince.
Anyone important?
I don't know. Look, Mrs. Elliott, I liked Lizzie. She was real kind to me a couple of times when I got down, but we never got close. She was close with Chloe, and...
She paused, and added hurriedly.
Nothing like that, you know, but her and Chloe and Mac, they used to share things, you know, talk and everything.
Can I talk to them?
Her eyes flickered to the corners of the cabin, as if she had just heard an inexplicable noise. She looked hunted.
It's better if you don't. Jerry, you know, he doesn't like us talking to the public. If he catches us...
I put every ounce of envoy persuasiveness into stance and tone.
Well, maybe you could ask for me.
The hunted look deepened, but her voice firmed up.
Sure, I'll ask around, but not now. You gotta go. Come back tomorrow, the same time, same cabin. I'll stay free for this time. Say you made an appointment.
I took her hand in both of mine.
Thank you, Anemone.
My name's not Anemone,
she said abruptly.
I'm called Louise. Call me Louise.
Thank you, Louise.
I held on to her hand. Thank you for doing this.
Look, I'm not promising anything,
she said with an attempt at roughness.
Like I said, I'll ask. That's all. Now you go, please.
She showed me how to cancel the remainder of my payment on the credit console, and the door hinged immediately open. No change. I didn't say anything else. I didn't try to touch her again. I walked out through the open door and left her standing there with her arms wrapped around her chest and her head down, staring at the satin-padded floor of the cabin as if she was seeing it for the first time, lit in red. Outside, the street was unchanged. The two dealers were still there, deep in negotiations with a huge Mongol who was leaning on the hood of the car, looking at something between his hands. The octopus arched its arms to let me pass, and I stepped into the drizzle. The Mongol looked up as I passed, and a flinch of recognition passed over his face. I stopped, turning in mid-step, and he dropped his gaze again, muttering something to the dealers. The Nurikem came online like a shiver of cold water inside. I moved across the space to the car, and the sparse conversation between the three men dried up instantly. Hands slid into pouches and pockets. Something was pushing me. Something that had very little to do with the look the Mongol had given me. Something dark that had spread its wings on the low-key misery of the cabin. Something uncontrolled that Virginia Vidara would have bawled me out for. I could hear Jimmy DeSoto whispering in my ear.
"You waiting for me?" I asked the Mongol's back, and saw how the muscles in it tensed.
Maybe one of the dealers felt it coming. He held up his exposed hands in a placatory gesture.
"Look, man,"
he began weakly. I sliced him a glance out of the corner of my eye, and he shut up.
I said...
That was when it all came apart. The Mongol pushed himself off the car hood with a roar and swatted at me with the arm the size of a ham. The blow never landed, but even deflecting it, I staggered back a pace. The dealers skinned their weapons, deadly little slabs of black and gray metal that spat and yapped in the rain.
I twisted away from the traceries of fire, using the Mongol for cover, and shot a palm heel into his contorted face. Bone crunched, and I came around him onto the car while the dealers were still trying to work out where I was. The Norikim made their movements into the pouring of thick honey. One gun-filled fist came tracking toward me, and I smashed the fingers around the metal with a side-flung kick. The owner howled, and the edge of my hand cracked into the other dealer's temple. Both men reeled off the car, one still moaning, the other insensible or dead. I came up into a crouch. The Mongol took off, running. I vaulted the roof of the ground car and went after him without thinking. The concrete jarred my feet as I landed, sent splinters of pain lancing up both shins, but the Nurikem damped it down instantly, and I was only a dozen meters behind. I threw out my chest and sprinted. Ahead of me, the Mongol bounced around in my field of vision like a combat jet trying to elude pursuing fire. For a man of his size, he was remarkably fast, flitting between the marching support pillars of the expressway and into the shadows a good 20 meters ahead now. I put on speed, wincing at the sharp pains in my chest. Rain slapped at my face. Fucking cigarettes. We came out from under the pillars and across a deserted intersection where the traffic lights leaned at drunken angles. One of them stirred feebly, lights changing as the Mongol passed it. A senile robot voice husked out at me. "Cross now, cross now, cross now." I already had. The echoes followed me beseechingly up the street. Past the derelict hulks of vehicles that hadn't moved from their curbside resting places in years. Barred and shuttered frontages that might or might not be rolled up for business during daylight hours. Steam rising from a grate in the side of the street like something alive. The paving under my feet was slick with the rain and a gray muck distilled from items of decaying garbage. The shoes that had come with Bancroft's summer suit were thin-soled and devoid of useful grip. Only the perfect balance of the Nurikim kept me upright. The Mongol cast a glance back over his shoulder as he came level with two parked wrecks, saw I was still there, and broke left across the street as soon as he cleared the last vehicle. I tried to adjust my trajectory and cut him off, crossing the street at an angle before I reached the wrecked cars, but my quarry had timed the trap too well. I was already on the first wreck, and I skidded, trying to stop in time. I bounced off the hood of the rusting vehicle into a shop front shutter. The metal clanged and sizzled. A low-current anti-loitering charge stung my hands. Across the street, the Mongol stretched the distance between us by another 10 meters. A wayward speck of traffic moved in the sky above me. I spotted the fleeing figure on the other side of the street and kicked off from the curb, cursing the impulse that had made me turn down Bancroft's offer of armaments. At this range, a beam weapon would have carved the Mongol's legs out from under him easily. Instead, I tucked in behind him and tried to find the lung capacity from somewhere to close up the gap again. Maybe I could panic him into tripping. That wasn't what happened, but it was close enough. The buildings to our left gave way to wasteland bordered by a sagging fence. The Mongol looked back again and made his first mistake. He stopped, threw himself on the fence, which promptly collapsed, and scrambled over into the darkness beyond. I grinned and followed. Finally, I had the advantage. Perhaps he was hoping to lose himself in the darkness, or expecting me to twist an ankle over the uneven ground. But the envoy conditioning squeezed my pupils into instant dilation in the low light surroundings and mapped my steps over the uneven surface with lightning speed, and the Nurikim put my feet there with rapidity to match. The ground ghosted by beneath me the way it had beneath Jimmy DeSoto in my dream. Given 100 meters of this, I was going to overtake my Mongol friend, unless he too had augmented vision. In the event, the wasteland ran out before that, but by then there was barely the original 12 meters between us when we both hit the fence on the far side. He scaled the wire, dropped to the ground, and started up the street while I was still climbing, but then abruptly he appeared to stumble. I cleared the top of the fence and swung down lightly. He must have heard me drop, though, because he spun out of the huddle, still not finished clipping together the thing in his hands. The muzzle came up, and I dived for the street. I hit hard, skinning my hands and rolling. Lightning torched the night where I had been. The stink of ozone washed over me, and the crackle of disrupted air curled in my ears. I kept rolling, and the particle blaster lit up again, charring past my shoulder. The damp street hissed with steam in its wake. I scrambled for cover that wasn't there.
"Lay down your weapon!"
A cluster of pulsating lights dropped vertically from above, and the loudspeaker barked down the night like the voice of a robot god. A searchlight exploded in the street and flooded us with white fire. From where I lay, I screwed up my eyes and could just make out the police transport, a regulation crowd control 5 meters off the street, lights flashing. The soft storm of its turbines swept flapping wings of paper and plastic up against the walls of nearby buildings and pinned them there like dying moths.
"Stand where you are,"
the loudspeaker thundered again.
"Lay down your weapon."
The Mongol brought his particle blaster around in a searing arc, and the transport bucked as its pilot tried to avoid the beam. Sparks showered off one turbine where the weapon found its mark, and the transport sideslipped badly. Machine rifle fire answered from a mounting somewhere below the vessel's nose, but by that time the Mongol was across the street, had torched down a door, and was gone through the smoking gap. Screams from somewhere within. I picked myself slowly up off the ground and watched as the transport settled to within a meter of the ground. An extinguisher canister fumed into life on the smoldering engine canopy and dripped white foam onto the street. Just behind the pilot's window, a hatch whined up, and Kristen Ortega stood framed in the opening.
Chapter 10. The transport was a stripped-down version of the one that had given me the ride out to Suntouch House, and it was noisy in the cabin. Ortega had to shout to make herself heard above the engines.
"We'll put in a sniffer squad, but if he's connected, he can get stuff that'll change his body's chemical signature before dawn. After that, we're down to witness sightings, Stone Age stuff, and in this part of town..."
The transport banked, and she gestured down at the warren of streets below.
"Look at it. Licktown, they call it. Used to be called Potrero way back. They say it was a nice area."
"So what happened?" Ortega shrugged in her steel lattice seat.
"Economic crisis. You know how it is. One day you own a house, your sleeve policy's paid up. The next you're on the street looking at a single lifespan."
"That's tough."
"Yeah, isn't it?"
the detective said dismissively.
"Kovach, what the fuck were you doing at Jerry's?"
"Getting an itch scratched," I growled.
"Any laws against it?"
She looked at me.
"You aren't getting greased in Jerry's. You're barely in there 10 minutes.
I lifted my own shoulders and made an apologetic face. "You ever been downloaded into a male body straight out of the tank? You'll know what it's like. Hormones. Things get rushed. Places like Jerry's, performance isn't an issue." Ortega's lips curved in something approximating a smile. She leaned forward across the space between us.
"Bullshit, Kovach. Bullshit. I accessed what they've got on you at Millsport. Psychological profile. They call it the Kemmerich gradient. And yours is so steep you'd need pitons and rope to get up it. Everything you do, performance is going to be an issue."
"Well..." I fed myself a cigarette and ignited it as I spoke. "You know, there's a lot you can do for some women in 10 minutes. Ortega rolled her eyes and waved the comment away as if it was a fly buzzing around her face.
"Right. And you're telling me with the credit you have from Bancroft, Jerry's is the best you can afford?"
"It's not about cost," I said, and wondered if that was the truth of what brought people like Bancroft down to Licktown. Ortega leaned her head against the window and looked out at the rain. She didn't look at me.
"You're chasing leads, Kovach. You went down to Jerry's to follow up something Bancroft did there. Given time, I can find out what that was, but it'd be easier if you just told me."
"Why? You told me the Bancroft case was closed. What's your interest?" That brought her eyes back around to mine, and there was a light in them.
"My interest is keeping the peace. Maybe you haven't noticed, but every time we meet, it's to the sound of heavy-caliber gunfire."
I spread my hands. "I'm unarmed. All I'm doing is asking questions."
"And speaking of questions, how come you were sitting on my shoulder when the fun started?"
"Just lucky, I guess."
I let that one go. Ortega was tailing me, that much was certain. and that in turn meant there had to be more to the Bancroft case than she was admitting. "What's going to happen to my car?" I asked.
"We'll have it picked up. Notify the rental company. Someone can come and get it from the impound. Unless you want it."
I shook my head.
"Tell me something, Kovach. Why'd you rent a ground car? On what Bancroft's paying you, you could have had one of these."
She slapped the bulkhead by her side.
"I like to go places on the ground," I said. "You get a better sense of distance that way, and on Harlan's world, we don't get up in the air much."
"Really?"
"Really. Listen, the guy who nearly torched you out of the sky back there..."
"Excuse me?"
She cranked up one eyebrow in what by now I was beginning to think of as her trademark expression.
"Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we saved your sleeve back there. You were the one looking down the wrong end of the hardware."
I gestured. "Whatever. It was waiting for me."
"Waiting for you?"
Whatever she really thought, Ortega's face was disbelieving.
"According to those stiff dealers we loaded into the wagon, he was buying product. An old customer, they say."
I shook my head. "He was waiting for me. I went to talk to him. He took off."
"Maybe he didn't like your face. One of the dealers, I think it was the one whose skull you cracked, said you were looking jacked up to kill someone."
She shrugged again.
"They say you started it, and it certainly looks that way."
"In that case, why aren't you charging me?"
"Oh, with what?"
She exhaled an imaginary plume of smoke.
"Organic damage, surgery reparable to a pair of stiff peddlers, endangering police property, breach of the peace in Licktown. Give me a break, Kovach. This sort of thing goes down every night outside Jerry's. I'm too tired for the paperwork."
The transport tipped, and through the window I could see the dim form of the Hendrix's tower. I'd accepted Ortega's offer of a ride home in much the same spirit as I had the police lift out to Suntouch House, to see where it would take me. Envoy wisdom. Go with the flow and see what it shows you. I'd no reason to suppose Ortega was lying to me about our destination, but still part of me was surprised to see that tower. Envoys aren't big on trust. After an initial wrangle with the Hendrix about landing permission, the pilot set us down on a grimy-looking drop pad atop the tower. I could feel the wind tucking at the transport's lightweight body as we landed, and as the hatch unfolded upward, the cold came battering aboard. I got up to go. Ortega stayed where she was, watching me go with a lopsided look that I still couldn't work out. The charge I'd felt last night was back. I could feel the need to say something pressing on me like an impending sneeze.
"Hey, how'd the bus go down on Cadman?"
She shifted in the seat and stuck out one long leg to rest her boot on the chair I'd just vacated. A thin smile.
"Grinding through the machine," she said. "We'll get there."
"Good." I climbed out into the wind and rain, raising my voice.
"Thanks for the lift."
She nodded gravely, then tipped her head back to say something to the pilot behind her. The whine of the turbines built, and I ducked hurriedly out from under the hatch as it began to close. As I stepped back, the transport unglued itself and lifted away, lights flashing. I caught a final glimpse of Ortega's face through the rain-streaked cabin window. Then the wind seemed to carry the little craft away like an autumn leaf, wheeling away and down toward the streets below. In seconds, it was indistinguishable from the thousands of other fires speckling the night sky. I turned and walked against the wind to the drop pad's access staircase. My suit was sodden from the rain. What had possessed Bancroft to outfit me for summer with the scrambled weather systems that Bay City had so far exhibited was beyond me. On Harlan's world, when it's winter, it stays that way long enough for you to make decisions about your wardrobe. The upper levels of the Hendrix were in darkness, relieved only by the occasional glow of dying aluminum tiles, but the hotel obligingly lit my way with neon tubes that flickered on in my path and died out again behind me. It was a weird effect, making me feel as if I was carrying a candle or torch.
"You have a visitor,"
the hotel said chattily as I got into the elevator and the doors whirred closed.
I slammed my hand against the emergency stop button, raw flesh where I'd skinned my palm, stinging.
What?
You have a visit.
Yeah, I heard. It occurred to me briefly to wonder if the AI could take offense at my tone. Who is it, and where are they?
She identifies herself as Miriam Bancroft. Subsequent search of the city archives has confirmed sleeve identity. I have allowed her to wait in your room, since she is unarmed and you left nothing of consequence there this morning. Aside from refreshment, she has touched nothing.
Feeling my temper rising, I found focus on a small dent in the metal of the elevator door and made an attempt at calm. This is interesting. Do you make arbitrary decisions like this for all your guests?
Miriam Bancroft is the wife of Lorenz Bancroft,
the hotel said reproachfully,
who in turn is paying for your room. Under the circumstances, I thought it wise not to create unnecessary tensions.
I looked up at the ceiling of the elevator. You've been checking up on me?
A background check is part of the contract I operate under. Any information retained is wholly confidential, unless subpoenaed under UN Directive 231.4.
Yeah? So what else you know?
Lieutenant Takashi Lev Kovach,
the hotel said.
Also known as Mamba Lev, One Hand Rending, the Ice Pick. Born New Pest, Harlan's World, 35th May, 187, Colonial Reckoning. Recruited to UN Protectorate Forces, 11th September, 204. Selected for Envoy Corps Enhancement, 31st June, 211, during routine screening.
All right. Inwardly, I was a little surprised at how deep the AI had got. Most people's records dry up as soon as the trace goes off-world. Interstellar needle casts are expensive. Unless the Hendricks had just broken into Warden Sullivan's records, which was illegal. Ortega's comment about the hotel's previous charge sheet drifted back to me. What kind of crimes did an AI commit, anyway?
It also occurred to me that Mrs. Bancroft is probably here in connection with the matter of her husband's death, which you are investigating. I thought you would prefer to speak to her if possible, and she was not amenable to waiting in the lobby.
I sighed and unpinned my hand from the elevator stop button. No, I bet she wasn't. She was seated in the window, nursing a tall, ice-filled glass and watching the lights of the traffic below. The room was in darkness, broken only by the soft glow of the service hatch and the tricolored neon-frame liquor cabinet. Enough to see that she wore some kind of shawl over her work trousers and a body-molded leotard. She didn't turn her head when I let myself in, so I advanced across the room into her field of vision. "The hotel told me you were here," I said, in case you were wondering why I didn't unsleeve myself in shock. She looked up at me and shook her hair back from her face.
"Very dry, Mr. Kovach. Should I applaud?"
I shrugged. "You might say thank you for the drink." She examined the top of her glass thoughtfully for a moment, then flicked her eyes up again.
"Thank you for the drink."
"Don't mention it." I went to the cabinet and surveyed the bottles racked there. A bottle of 15-year-old single malt suggested itself. I uncorked it, sniffed at the neck of the bottle, and picked out a tumbler. Keeping my eyes on my hands as they poured, I said, "Have you been waiting long?"
"About an hour. Armal Prescott told me you'd gone to Licktown, so I guessed you'd be back late. Did you have some trouble?"
I held on to the first mouthful of whiskey, felt it sear the internal cuts where Cadman had put the boot in, and swallowed hastily. I grimaced. "Now, why would you think that, Mrs. Bancroft?" She made an elegant gesture with one hand.
"No reason. Do you not want to talk about it?"
"Not particularly." I sank into a huge lounger bag at the foot of the crimson bed and sat staring across the room at her. Silence descended. From where I was sitting, she was backlit by the window and her face was deep in shadow. I kept my eyes leveled on the faint gleam that might have been her left eye. After a while, she shifted in her seat and the ice in her glass clicked.
"Well,
She cleared her throat.
What would you like to talk about?
I waved my glass at her. Let's start with why you're here.
I want to know what progress you've made.
You can get a progress report from me tomorrow morning. I'll file one with Almal Prescott before I go out. Come on, Mrs. Bancroft, it's late. You can do better than that. For a moment, I thought she might leave, the way she twitched. But then she took her glass in both hands, bent her head over it as if in search of inspiration, and after a long moment, looked up again.
I want you to stop,
she said. I let the words sink into the darkened room. Why? I saw her lips part in the smile, heard the sound her mouth made as it split.
Why not?
She said. Well, I sifted my drink, sluicing the alcohol around the cuts in my mouth to shut down my hormones. To begin with, there's your husband. He's made it pretty clear that cutting and running could seriously damage my health. Then there's the $100,000. And after that, well, then we get into the ethereal realm of things like promises and my word. And to be honest, I'm curious.
$100,000 isn't so much money, she said carefully. And the protectorate is big. I could give you the money, find a place for you to go where Lorenz would never find you.
Yes. That leaves my word. And my curiosity. She sat forward over her drink.
Let's not pretend, Mr. Kovach. Lorenz didn't contract you, he dragged you here. He locked you into a deal you had no choice but to accept. No one could say you were honor-bound.
I'm still curious.
Maybe I could satisfy that, she said softly.
I swallowed more whiskey. Yeah? Did you kill your husband, Mrs. Bancroft? She made an impatient gesture.
I'm not talking about your game of detectives. You are curious about other things, are you not?
I'm sorry. I looked at her over the rim of my glass. Miriam Bancroft pushed herself off the window shelf and set her hips against it. She set down the glass with exaggerated care and leaned back on her hands so that her shoulders lifted. It changed the shape of her breasts, moving them beneath the sheer material of her leotard.
Do you know what Merge 9 is?
She asked, a little unsteadily. Empathin? I dug the name out from somewhere. Some thoroughly armed robbery crew I knew back on Harlan's world, friends of Virginia Vidora's, the little blue bugs. They did all their work on Merge 9, said it welded them into a tighter team. Bunch of fucking psychos.
Yes, Empathin. Empathin derivatives, tailed with Sateron and Gaiden enhancers. This sleeve...
She gestured down at herself, spread fingers brushing the curves.
This is state-of-the-art biochemtech, out of the Nakamura labs. I secrete Merge 9 when... aroused. In my sweat, in my saliva, in my cunt, Mr. Kovach.
And she came off the shelf, shawl sliding off her shoulders to the floor. It puddled silkenly around her feet, and she stepped over it toward me. Well, there's Elaine Marriott, honorable and strong in all his myriad Xperia incarnations. And then there's reality. In reality, and whatever it costs, there are some things you don't turn away from. I met her halfway across the room. Merge 9 was already in the air, in the scent of her body, and the water vapor on her breath. I drew in a deep breath and felt the chemical triggers go off like plucked strings in the pit of my stomach. My drink was gone, set aside somewhere, and the hand that had held it was molded around one of Miriam Bancroft's jutting breasts. She drew my head down with hands on either side, and I found it there again. Merge 9 and the beads of sweat
webbed in the soft down that ran in a line down her cleavage. I tugged at the seam of the leotard, untrapping the breasts pressed beneath it, tracing and finding one nipple with my mouth. Above me, I felt her mouth gasp open, and knew the empathen was working its way into my sleeve's brain, tripping dormant telepath instincts, and sending out feelers for the intense aura of arousal that this woman was generating. Knew as well that she would be beginning to taste the flesh of her own breast in my mouth. Once triggered, the empathen rush was like a volleyed tennis ball, building intensity with every rebound from one inflamed sensorium to the other, until the merge reached a climax just short of unbearable. Miriam Bancroft was beginning to moan now, as we sank to the floor and I moved back and forth between her breasts, rubbing their springy resistance over my face. Her hands had turned hungry, grasping and digging softly with nails at my flanks and the swollen ache between my legs. We scrabbled feverishly at each other's clothing, mouths trembling with the need to fill themselves, and when we had shed everything we wore, the rug beneath us seemed to lay individual strands of heat on our skin. I settled over her, and my stubble rasped faintly over the sprung smoothness of her belly, my mouth making wet O's on its path downward. Then there was the deep salt taste as my tongue tracked down the creases of her cunt, soaking up Merge 9 with her juices and coming back to press and flick at the tiny butt of her clitoris. Somewhere, at the other end of the world, my penis was pulsing in her hand. A mouth closed over the head and sucked gently. Blending, our climaxes built rapidly and with unerring concurrence, and the mixed signals of the Merge 9 union blurred until I could find no distinction between the excruciating tautness of the prick between her fingers and the pressure of my own tongue somewhere indistinct up beyond its feasible reach inside her. Her thighs clamped around my head. There was a grunting sound, but whose throat it came from I was no longer aware. Separateness melted away into mutual sensory overload, tension building layer after layer, peak after peak, and then suddenly she was laughing at the warm, salty splash over her face and fingers, and I was clamped against her corkscrewing hips as her own simultaneous crest swept her away. For a while, there was trembling release, in which the slightest movement, the sliding of flesh against flesh, brought sobbing spasms from us both. Then, gift of the long period my sleeve had been in the tank, the sweaty images of an enemy pressed against the glass of the biocabin, my penis twitched and began to tighten again. Miriam Bancroft nudged at it with her nose, ran the tip of her tongue along and around it, licking off the stickiness until it was smooth and taut against her cheek, then swung around and straddled me. Reaching back for balance and hold, she sank down, impaling herself on the shaft with a long, warm groan. She leaned over me, breasts swinging, and I craned and sucked hungrily at the elusive globes. My hands came up to grasp her thighs where they were spread on either side of my body. And then, the motion. The second time took longer, and the empathen lent it an air that was more aesthetic than sexual. Taking her cue from the signals gusting out of my sensorium, Miriam Bancroft settled into a slow, churning motion, while I watched her taut belly and out-thrust breasts with detached lust. For no reason I could discern, the Hendrix piped a slow, deep reggae beat in from the corners of the room, and a lighting effect patterned the ceiling above us with swirling blotches of red and purple. When the effect tilted and the swinging stars came to dapple our bodies, I felt my mind tilting with it, and my perceptions slid sideways out of focus. There was only the grinding of Miriam Bancroft's hips over me, and fragmented glimpses of her body and face wrapped in colored light. When I came, it was a distant explosion that seemed to have more to do with the woman shuddering to a halt astride me than with my own sleeve. Later, as we lay side by side,
hands milking each other through further inconclusive peaks and troughs, she said,
"What do you think of me?"
I looked down the length of my body to what her hand was doing and cleared my throat. "Is that a trick question?" She laughed, the same throaty cough that I had warmed to in the chart room at Suntouch House.
"No, I want to know."
"Do you care?" It was not said harshly, and somehow the merged nine leached it of its brutal overtones.
"You think that's what it is to be a meth?"
The word sounded strange on her lips, as though she were not talking about herself.
"You think we don't care about anything young?"
"I don't know," I said truthfully. "It's a point of view that I've heard. Living 300 years is bound to change your perspectives."
"Yes, it does."
Her breath caught slightly as my fingers slid inside her.
"Yes, like that. But you don't stop caring. You see it all sliding past you, and all you want to do is grab on, hold on to something, to stop it all from draining away."
"Is that right?"
"Yes, it is. So, what do you think of me?"
I leaned over her and looked at the young woman's body she inhabited, the fine lines of her face, and the old, old eyes. I was still stoned on the merge nine, and I couldn't find a flaw anywhere in her. She was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen. I gave up the struggle for objectivity and bowed my head to kiss her on one breast. "Miriam Bancroft, you are a wonder to behold, and I would willingly trade my soul to possess you." She staved off a chuckle.
"I'm serious. Do you like me?"
"What kind of question?"
"I'm serious."
The words were grounded deeper than the empathin. I pulled in some control and looked her in the eyes. "Yes," I said simply.
"I like you."
Her voice lowered into her throat.
"Do you like what we did?"
"Yes, I like what we did."
"Do you want more?"
"Yes, I want more." She sat up to face me. The milking motions of her hand grew harder, more demanding. Her voice hardened to match.
"Say it again."
"I want more of you." She pushed me down with a hand flat on my chest and leaned over me. I was growing back to somewhere near a full erection. She started to time her strokes, slow and sharp.
"Out west,"
she murmured.
"About 5 hours away by cruiser, there's an island. It's mine. No one goes there. There's a 50-kilometer exclusion umbrella, satellite patrolled, but it's beautiful. I've built a complex there, with a clone bank and a resleeving facility."
Her voice got that uneven edge to it again.
"I sometimes decant the clones, sleeve copies of myself, to play. Do you understand what I'm offering you?"
I made a noise. The image she had just planted, of being the focus for a pack of bodies like this one, all orchestrated by the same mind, tightened the last notches on my hard-on, and her hand slid up and down its full length as if machined there.
"What was that?"
She leaned over me, brushing her nipples across my chest.
"How long?"
I managed, through the coiling and uncoiling of my stomach muscles, through the flesh and mistones of the Merge Nine. "Is this fun park invitation good for?" She grinned then, a grin of pure lechery.
"Unlimited rides," she said.
"But for a limited period only, right?" She shook her head.
"No, you don't understand me. This place is mine, all of it. The island, the sea around it, everything on it is mine. I can keep you there as long as you care to stay, until you tire of it."
That might take a long time.
No.
There was a hint of sadness in the way she shook her head this time, and her gaze fell a little.
No, it won't.
The pistoning grip on my penis slackened fractionally. I groaned and grabbed at her hand, forcing it back into motion. The move seemed to rekindle her, and she went to work again in earnest, speeding up and slowing down, bending to feed me her breasts or supplement her strokes with sucking and licking. My time perception spiraled out of sight, to be replaced with an endless gradient of sensation that sloped upward, excruciatingly slowly, toward a peak I could hear myself begging for in drugged tones somewhere far away. As the orgasm loomed, I was vaguely aware through the Merge 9 link that she was sinking fingers into herself, rubbing with an uncontrolled desire completely at odds with the calculation with which she manipulated me. Fine-tuned by the empathon, she brought on her own peak a few seconds before mine, and as I started to come, she smeared her own juices hard over my face and thrashing body. Whiteout. And when I came to, much later, with the Merge 9 crash laid across me like a lead weight, she was gone like a fever dream. Chapter 11. When you have no friends and the woman you slept with last night has left you with a screaming head and without a word, you have a limited number of options. When I was younger, I used to go out looking for squalid brawls in the streets of Newpest. This got a couple of people stabbed, neither of them me, and led in turn to my apprenticeship in one of the Highlands World gangs, Newpest chapter. Later on, I upgraded this kind of retreat by joining the military, brawling with a purpose and with more extensive weaponry, but as it turned out, just as squalid. I don't suppose I should have been as surprised as I was. The only thing the Marine Corps recruiters had really wanted to know was how many fights I had won. These days, I've evolved a slightly less destructive response to general chemical malaise. When a 40-minute swim in the Hendrix's underground pool failed to dispel either the longing for Miriam Bancroft's torrid company or the Merge 9 hangover, I did the only thing I felt equipped for. I ordered painkillers from room service and went shopping. Bay City had already settled into the swing of the day by the time I finally hit the streets, and the commercial center was choked with pedestrians. I stood on the edges for a couple of minutes, then dived in and began to look in windows. A blonde Marine sergeant with the unlikely name of Serenity Carlyle taught me to shop, back on the world. Prior to that, I had always employed a technique best described as precision purchase. You identify your target, you go in, get it, and come out. You can't get what you want, cut your losses, and get out equally fast. Over the period that we spent together, Serenity weaned me off this approach and sold me her philosophy of consumer grazing. Look, she told me one day in a Millsport coffee house, shopping, actual physical shopping, could have been phased out centuries ago if they'd wanted it that way.
They who?
People, society. She waved a hand impatiently. Whoever. They had the capacity back then. Mail order, virtual supermarkets, automated debiting systems. It could have been done, and it never happened. What does that tell you?
At 22 years old, a Marine Corps grunt via the street gangs of Newpest had told me nothing. Carlyle took in my blank look and sighed.
It tells you that people like shopping, that it satisfies a basic acquisitive need at a genetic level, something we inherited from our hunter-gatherer ancestors. Oh, you've got automated convenience shopping for basic household items, mechanical food distribution systems for the marginalized poor, but you've also got a massive proliferation of commercial hives and specialty markets in food and crafts that people physically have to go to. Now, why would they do that if they didn't enjoy it?
I probably shrugged, maintaining my youthful cool.
Shopping is physical interaction. Exercise of decision-making capacity, sating with a desire to acquire, and an impulse to more acquisition, a scouting urge. It's so basically fucking human when you think about it. You've got to learn to love it, Tack. I mean, you can cross the whole archipelago on a hover. You never even need to get wet. But that doesn't take the basic pleasure out of swimming, does it? Learn to shop well, Tack. Get flexible. Enjoy the uncertainty.
Enjoyment wasn't exactly what I was feeling at the moment, but I stuck with it and I stayed flexible, true to Serenity Carlyle's creed. I started out vaguely looking for a heavy-duty waterproof jacket, but the thing that finally pulled me into a shop was a pair of all-terrain walking boots. The boots were followed by loose black trousers and a crossover insulated top with enzyme seals that ran all the way from waist to a tight crew neck. I'd seen variations on the outfit 100 times on the streets of Bay City so far. Surface assimilation. It would do. After brief hungover reflection, I added a defiant red silk bandana across my forehead, New Pest Gang style. It wasn't exactly assimilative, but it went with a vaguely mutinous irritation that had been rising in me since yesterday. I dumped Bancroft's summer suit in a trash bin on the street outside and left the shoes beside it. Before I left it, I searched through the jacket pockets and came up with 2 cards. The doctor at Bay City Central and Bancroft's armorer. Larkin and Green proved to be the names not of 2 gunsmiths, but of 2 streets that intersected on a leafy slope called Russian Hill. The auto cab had some visitor's blurb about the area, but I skipped it. Larkin and Green, armorers since 2203, was a discreet corner facade extending less than a half dozen meters along each street, but bordered by blinded units that looked as if they had probably been annexed. I pushed through well-cared-for wooden doors into the cool, oil-smelling interior. Inside, the place reminded me of the chart room at Suntouch House. There was space and light flooding in from 2 stories of tall windows. The upper floor had been removed and replaced with a wide gallery on 4 sides overlooking the ground level. The walls were hung with flat display cases, and the space under the gallery overhang hosted heavy glass-topped trolleys that performed the same function. There was the faint tang of an ambient modifier in the air, scent of old trees under the gunwale, and the floor under my newly booted feet was carpeted. A black steel face appeared over the gallery rail. Green photoreceptors burned in place of eyes.
"May I be of assistance, sir?"
"I'm Takashi Kovacs. I'm here from Lorenz Bancroft," I said, tipping my head back to meet the mandroid's gaze. "I'm looking for some hardware."
"Of course, sir."
The voice was smoothly male and devoid of any sales subsonics I could detect.
"Mr. Bancroft told us to expect you. I am with a client, but I shall be down presently. Please make yourself at home. There are chairs to your left and a refreshments cabinet. Please help yourself."
The head disappeared, and a murmured conversation I had vaguely registered when I came in was resumed. I located the refreshments cabinet, found it stocked with alcohol and cigars, and closed it hurriedly. The painkillers had taken the edge off the Merge 9 hangover, but I was in no fit state for further abuse. With a light shock, I realized I'd gone through the day so far without a cigarette. I wandered over to the nearest display case and looked in at a selection of samurai swords. There were date tickets attached to the scabbards. Some of them were older than me. The next case held a rack of brown and gray projectile weapons that seemed to have been grown rather than machined. The barrels sprouted from organically curved wrappings that flared gently back to the stock. These, too, were dated back into the last century. I was trying to decipher the curled engraving on a barrel when I heard a metallic tread on the staircase behind me.
"Has Sir found anything to his liking?"
I turned to face the approaching mandroid. Its entire body was the same polished gunmetal, molded into the muscle configuration of an archetypal human male. Only the genitals were absent. The face was long and thin, fine-featured enough to hold attention despite its immobility. The head was carved into furrows to represent thick, back-combed hair. Stamped across the chest was the almost eroded legend, Mars Expo 2076. "Just looking," I said, and gestured back at the guns. "Are these made of wood?" The green photoreceptor gaze regarded me gravely.
"That is correct, sir. The stocks are a beech hybrid. They are all handmade weapons. Kalashnikov, Purdy, and Beretta.
We stock all the European houses here. Which was Sir interested in?
I looked back. There was a curious poetry to the forms, something slung partway between functional bluntness and organic grace, something that cried out to be cradled, to be used. They're a bit ornate for me. I had in mind something a little more practical.
Certainly, sir. Can we assume Sir is not a novice in this field?
I grinned at the machine.
We can assume that. Then perhaps Sir would care to tell me what his preference in the past have been.
Smith & Wesson 11mm Magnum, Ingram 40 Flechette Gun, Sunjet Particle Thrower, but that wasn't in this sleeve.
The green receptors glowed. No comment. Perhaps it hadn't been programmed for light conversation with envoys. And what exactly is Sir looking for in this sleeve?
I shrugged. Something subtle, something not. Projectile weapons, and a blade. The heavy one needs to be something like the Smith.
The mandroid became quite still. I could almost hear the whirring of data retrieval.
I wondered briefly how a machine like this had come to wind up here. It had clearly not been designed for the job. On Harlan's world, you don't see many mandroids. They're expensive to build, compared to a synthetic or even a clone. And most jobs that require a human form are better done by those organic alternatives. The truth is that a robot-human is a pointless collision of two disparate functions. Artificial intelligence, which really works better strung out on a mainframe, and hard-wearing, hazard-proof bodywork, which most cyber engineering firms designed to spec for the task at hand. The last robot I'd seen on the world was a gardening crab. The photoreceptors brightened slightly, and the thing's posture unlocked.
If Sir would care to come this way, I believe I have the right combination.
I followed the machine through a door that blended so well with the decor of the back wall that I hadn't seen it, and down a short corridor. Beyond was a long, low room, whose unpainted plaster walls were lined with raw fiberglass packing cases. There were a number of people working quietly at points up and down the room. The air carried the businesslike rattle of hardware and practiced hands. The mandroid led me to a small, gray-haired man, dressed in grease-streaked coveralls, who was stripping down an electromag bolt thrower as if it were a roast chicken. He looked up as we approached.
Chip?
He nodded at the machine and ignored me.
Clive, this is Takashi Kovach. He's a friend of Mr. Bancroft, looking for equipment. I'd like you to show him the Nemex and a Phillips gun, and then pass him on to Sheila for a blade weapon.
Clive nodded again and set aside the electromag.
This way, he said.
The mandroid touched my arm lightly.
Should Sir require anything further, I shall be in the showroom.
It bowed fractionally and left. I followed Clive along the rows of packing cases to where a variety of handguns were laid out on piles of plastic confetti. He selected one and turned back to me with it in his hands.
Second series Nemesis X, he said, holding out the gun. The Nemex, manufactured under license for Mannlicher Schonauer, fires a jacketed slug with a customized propellant called Druck 31. Very powerful, very accurate. The magazine takes 18 shells in a staggered clip. Bit bulky, but worth it in a firefight. Feel the weight.
I took the weapon and turned it over in my hands. It was a big, heavy-barreled pistol. Slightly longer than the Smith & Wesson, but well-balanced. I swapped it hand to hand for a while, getting the feel of it, squinted down the sight. Clive waited beside me patiently.
All right.
I handed it back. And something subtle?
Phillips squeeze gun.
Clive reached into an open packing case and dug inside the confetti until he came up with a slim gray pistol almost half the size of the Nemex.
A solid steel load. Uses an electromagnetic accelerator. Completely silent. Accurate up to about 20 meters. No recoil. And you've got a reverse field option on the generator that means the slugs can be retrieved from the target afterwards. Takes 10.
Batteries?
Specs are for between 40 and 50 discharges. After that, you're losing muzzle velocity with every shot. You get 2 replacement batteries included in the price and a recharging kit compatible with household power outlets.
Do you have a firing range? Somewhere I can try these out?
Out the back. But both these babies come with a virtual combat practice disc, and that's perfect parity between virtual and actual performance. Warranty guarantees it.
All right, fine.
Collecting on a guarantee like that might prove a slow process if some cowboy used the resulting unhandiness to put a bullet through your skull. No telling when you might get re-sleeved, if at all. But by now, the ache in my head was beginning to get through the painkillers. Maybe target practice wasn't the thing right at that moment. I didn't bother asking the price, either. It wasn't my money I was spending. Ammunition?
Comes in boxes of 5, both guns. But you get a free clip with the Nemex. Sort of a promotion for the new line. That gonna be enough?
Not really. Give me 2 5-packs for both guns.
10 clips each? There was a dubious respect in Clive's voice. 10 clips is a lot of ammunition for a handgun. But I discovered that there were times when being able to fill the air with bullets was worth a lot more than actually hitting anything.
And you wanted a blade, right?
That's right.
Sheila!
Clive turned away down the long room and called out to a tall woman with crew-cut blonde hair, who was sitting cross-legged on a crate with her hands in her lap and the matte gray of a virtual set masking her face. She looked around when she heard her name, remembered the mask, and tipped it off, blinking. Clive waved at her, and she uncoiled herself from the crate, swaying slightly from the shift back to reality as she got up.
"Sheila, this guy's looking for Steele. You want to help him out?"
"Sure." The woman reached out a lanky arm. "Name Sheila Sorensen. What kind of steel you looking for?"
I matched her grip. "Takashi Kovach. I need something I can throw in a hurry, but it's got to be small. Something I can strap to a forearm."
"All right," she said amiably. "Want to come with me? You finished here?"
Clive nodded at me.
"I'll take this stuff out to Chip, and he'll package it up for you. You want it for delivery or carry out?"
"Carry out."
"Thought so."
Sheila's end of the business turned out to be a small rectangular room with a couple of silhouette cork targets on one wall and an array of weapons ranging from stilettos to machetes hung on the other three. She selected a flat black knife with a gray metal blade about 15 centimeters long and took it down.
"Tebbit knife," she said inconsequentially. "Very nasty."
And with every appearance of casualness, she turned and unleashed the weapon at the left-hand target. It skipped through the air like something alive and buried itself in the silhouette's head.
"Tantalum steel alloy blade, webbed carbon hilt. There's a flint set in the pommel for waiting, and of course you can bash them over the head with that if you don't get them with a sharp end."
I stepped across to the target and freed the knife. The blade was narrow and honed to a razor's edge on each side. A shallow gutter ran down the center, delineated with a thin red line that had tiny, intricate characters etched into it. I tilted the weapon in an attempt to read the engraving, but it was in a code I didn't recognize. Light glinted dully off the gray metal.
"What's this?"
"What?"
Sheila moved to stand beside me.
"Oh, yeah. Bioweapon coating. The runnel is coated with C-381. Produces cyanide compounds on contact with hemoglobin. Well away from the edges, so if you cut yourself, there's no problem. But if you sink it in anything with blood..."
"Charming."
"Told you it was nasty, didn't I?"
There was pride in her voice.
"I'll take it."
Back out on the street, weighed down with my purchases, it occurred to me I'd need a jacket after all, if only to conceal the newly acquired arsenal. I cast a glance upward in search of an auto cab and decided instead that there was enough sun in the sky to justify walking. I thought at last that my hangover was beginning to recede. I was 3 blocks down the hill before I realized I was being tailed. It was the envoy conditioning, stirring sluggishly to life in the wake of the Merge 9, that told me. Enhanced proximity sense, the faintest shiver, and a figure in the corner of my eye once too often. This one was good. In a more crowded part of town, I might have missed it, but here the pedestrians were too thin on the ground to provide much camouflage. The Tebbit knife was strapped to my left forearm in a soft leather sheath with neural spring load.
but neither of the guns were accessible without making it obvious that I'd spotted my shadow. I debated trying to lose the tail, but abandoned the idea almost as soon as it occurred to me. It wasn't my town. I felt sludgy with chemicals, and anyway, I was carrying too much. Let whoever it was come shopping with me. I picked up my pace a little and worked my way gradually down into the commercial center, where I found an expensive thigh-length red-and-blue wool coat with Inuit-inspired totem pole figures chasing each other in lines across it. It wasn't quite what I'd had in mind, but it was warm and had numerous capacious pockets. Paying for it at the shop's glass front, I managed to catch a glimpse of my tail's face. Young. Caucasian. Dark hair. I didn't know him. The two of us crossed Union Square, pausing to take in another Resolution 653 demonstration that had stalled in a corner and was gradually wearing thin. The chants wavered, people drifted away, and the metallic bark of the PA system was beginning to sound plaintive. There was a good chance I could have slipped away in the crowd, but by now I couldn't be bothered. If the tail had been going to do anything other than watch, he'd had his chance back in the leafy seclusion of the hills. There was too much going on here for a hit. I steered my way through the remnants of the demonstration, brushing aside the odd leaflet, and then headed south toward Mission Street and the Hendricks. On my way down Mission, I stepped inadvertently into the cast radius of a street seller. Instantly, my head flooded with images. I was moving along an alley full of women whose clothing was designed to display more than they would have shown of themselves naked. Boots that turned legs into slices of consumer flesh above the knee, thighs with arrow-shaped bands pointing the way, structural support lifting and pressing breasts out for view, heavy, rounded pendants nestling gland-like in sweat-beaded cleavages. Tongues flickered out, licked across lips painted cherry red or tomb black, teeth bared in challenge. A tide of cool swept in across me, erasing the sweaty need and turning the posturing bodies into an abstract expression of womanhood. I found myself tracking angles and the circumferences of bulges like a machine, mapping the geometry of flesh and bone as if the woman were a species of plant. Beta-thenatine, the Reaper. Final offspring of an extended chemical family engineered for near-death research projects early in the millennium. Beta-thenatine brought the human body as close to flatline status as was feasible without gross cellular damage. At the same time, control stimulants in the Reaper molecule induced a clinical functioning of intellect, which had enabled researchers to go through artificially induced death experiences without the overwhelming sense of emotion and wonder that might mar their data perception. Used in smaller doses, Reaper produced a depth of cool indifference to such things as pain, arousal, joy, and grief. All the detachment that men had pretended for centuries, before the naked female form was there for the taking, in a capsule. It was almost custom-built for the male adolescent market. It was also an ideal military drug. Riding the Reaper. A Godwin's Dream renouncer monk could torch a village full of women and children and feel nothing but fascination for the way the flames melted flesh from bone. The last time I'd used beta-thenatine had been in street battles on Sharia, a full dose designed to bring body temperature down to room normal and slow my heart to a fractional rate. Tricks to beat the anti-personnel detectors on Sharian spider tanks. With no register on infrared, you could get up close, scale a leg, and crack the hatches with termite grenades. Concussed by the shockwave, the crew usually slaughtered as easily as newborn kittens.
"Got stiff, man,"
a hoarse voice said redundantly. I blinked away the broadcast and found myself looking at a pale Caucasian face beneath a gray cowl. The broadcast unit sat on his shoulder, tiny red active lights winking at me like bat eyes. On the world, there are very tight laws regulating the use of direct-ahead dissemination, and even accidental broadcasts can generate the same kind of violence as spilling someone's drink in a warfront bar. I shot out one arm and shoved the dealer hard in the chest. He staggered against a shop front.
"Hey!
Don't piss in my head, friend. I don't like it." I saw his hands snake down to a unit at his waist and guessed what was coming. Retargeting, I got the soft of his eyes under my stiffened fingers and was face to face with a hissing mound of wet membranous flesh nearly 2 meters tall. Tentacles writhed at me, and my hand was reaching into a phlegm-streaked hollow framed with thick black cilia. My gorge rose and my throat closed up. Riding out a shudder of revulsion, I pushed into the seething cilia and felt the slimy flesh give.
"You want to go on seeing? You'll unplug that shit," I said tightly.
The mound of flesh vanished, and I was back with the dealer, fingers still pressed hard into the upper curves of his eyeballs.
"All right, man, all right."
He held up his hands, palms out.
"You don't want this stuff, don't buy it. I'm just trying to make a living here."
I stepped back and gave him the space to get off the shop front he was pinned to.
"Where I come from, you don't go into people's heads on the street," I offered by way of explanation.
But he'd already sensed my retreat from the confrontation, and he just made a gesture with his thumb that I assumed was obscene.
"I give a fuck where you're from! Fucking grasshopper! Get out of my face!"
I left him there, wondering idly as I crossed the street if there was any moral difference between him and the genetic designers who had built Merge 9 into Miriam Bancroft's sleeve. I paused on a corner and bent my head to kindle a cigarette. Mid-afternoon, my first of the day.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.